One of the all-time great love stories is before us today on The Balanced Word. Stay with us.
The story of Ruth is fascinating as we look at this love story. To me, other than the love that God has for his people, Ruth and Boaz is the greatest love story in the Bible, I think. Now, there might be some people who say, well, what about Song of Solomon? And it's true. Song of Solomon is this love poem that a man has for one of his thousand women. To me, that's like, okay, yeah, you really love her, but you love a whole bunch of other people too. You know, Abraham and Sarah was a great love story, except Abraham tried to give Sarah away twice to foreign rulers in order to protect himself. Jacob and Rachel, but then he also married her sister. There's, you know, a lot of bad examples of love stories in the Bible and not a lot of good ones, but this one is a beautiful love story.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hand and the instrument I play. Wake up my voice. Let the world hear me say, you are worshipped and exalted here today.
Hey, do you enjoy a good love story? Maybe you're one of those that looks forward to sitting down to read a good romance novel, or can't wait for the latest chick flick to hit the big screen. Well, we've got a great love story for you today, and it features Ruth and Boaz. We're going through the Bible on The Balanced Word, highlighting various Bible stories. We'll meet you in the book of Ruth. Here's Pastor Dave Roth.
We're looking at our next Bible story. One of the things that I have really enjoyed going through these Bible stories is examining the characters that are involved and thinking about what makes them who they are. This morning, we are looking at the story of Ruth in the book of Ruth in the Old Testament. And in looking at Bible characters, I'm reminded of the contributing factors that make people who they are. There's always been sort of a tension because there are some people who believe that mostly we are who our genetics says we are, who we are biologically. And so for that perspective, heredity is the big factor. But there are other people that argue that more than heredity, environment, the area, the way in which we live, the way life is lived in front of us, our environment is what contributes. Now, for me, the idea of being a product of my heredity or of my environment is really scary, because I just see nightmares in both. The story of Ruth is fascinating as we look at this love story. To me, other than the love that God has for his people, Ruth and Boaz is the greatest love story in the Bible, I think. Now, there might be some people who say, well, what about Song of Solomon? And it's true. Song of Solomon is this love poem that a man has for one of his thousand women. To me, that's like, okay, yeah, you really love her, but you love a whole bunch of other people too. You know, Abraham and Sarah was a great love story, except Abraham tried to give Sarah away twice to foreign rulers in order to protect himself. Jacob and Rachel, but then he also married her sister. There's, you know, a lot of bad examples of love stories in the Bible and not a lot of good ones, but this one is a beautiful love story. And it comes in kind of an unlikely time of history. It was during the period of the judges. It's why Ruth comes right after the book of Judges. And we've been studying the last few weeks, talking about Gideon and Samson and this whole dark period in the history of Israel that was called the time when people did whatever was right in their own eyes. It was an ugly era, one of the darkest eras in the history of the nation. And in the middle of that darkness flowers forth this beautiful love story. And so I love it. Let's look at the story. And as we're looking at it, let's think about Ruth and Boaz and their heredity and their environment and see what you think really contributed to what they became. The story begins again. It says in chapter 1, it was the time of the judges. There was a guy named Elimelech, a Jewish guy who lived in the podunk town of Bethlehem. It was one of the more unseemly cities in the whole country of Israel. There was a famine in the land, and so he and his wife, Naomi, took their two boys, and they moved to Moab. Now, Moab wasn't a place that Jews were supposed to go. The Moabites were considered to be a cursed race. And so they should avoid Moabites at all costs. And yet they're so desperate, nothing's happening in Bethlehem, so they pick up and they move. They change their environment from the tacky Bethlehem to the cursed Moab. Bad move. Not only that, when you move to Moab, your two sons, who are they going to marry? So the two sons married two Moabite women. Moabite women had led Israelite men astray for a long time. Apparently they were good looking, but really immoral. These two boys marry these two hot Moabite girls. Then Elimelech dies. And then the two boys die. Just right, bang, bang, bang. And now here's poor Naomi, a name that means pleasant. She had a good reputation before she left. Now she's living in Moab, no way to support herself, and she has two daughters-in-law who would kind of be, it would be up to her to try to take care of them and head them out in life, because the Moabites would have rejected them for marrying Jewish guys. Now you go back to Israel, they're going to reject two Moabite girls. It was really a tough spot for Naomi, and she has lost her husband and her two kids. She decides the only thing left for me to do is to head back to my hometown, to Bethlehem. At least I know some people there. And so she starts to head out, and she talks to the two girls and the two wives and Orpah and Ruth. And she says, you guys don't want to come with me. I have nothing. Tradition says that if I have another boy, that you could marry him. But let's face it, I'm not showing any prospects of that. And even if I had a kid now, you know, by the time they were old enough to marry you, you'd be old. And I don't want my kids marrying somebody old. So she's like, just stay in Moab. You can get a fresh start here. And Orpah said, okay, I'll stay here. But Ruth, in this amazing expression of love, and look at what she says in chapter 1, beginning with verse 16. But Ruth said, don't beg me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. That's kind of amazing. She has no reason to kiss up to Naomi. She is basically selling her life down the river, because when she goes to Israel, she's going to be known as a Moabitess. And throughout the story, that's how they refer to her. Oh, the Moabite. So she's heading into a place whereby she is disdained. But her loyalty to her mother-in-law is shocking. And yet she says, I want to follow your God. I want to be with your people. Whether your people accept me or not, I don't care. I'm going to be there always. I will die there as your daughter. And so Naomi said, okay. So they head back and they start moving back into Israel and towards Bethlehem. And when they get there, the ladies are kind of shocked because they see Naomi. And again, her name means pleasant. They see her and they go, is this pleasant? She looked miserable. She was absolutely depressed and downtrodden. She was a mess from when she had come before. And she said, don't even call me pleasant anymore. Call me Mara, which means bitter, because I just am absolutely devastated by what life has done to me. Made wrong decisions. My husband's gone. My boys are gone. All I have is this Moabite that you're looking down on. I'm a mess. But she came back home. And as the story continues, it was about the beginning of harvest season. And so she sent Ruth out to collect grain in the fields. Now, the welfare system in those days, God had set it up under the law, when they would harvest, they wouldn't take two passes. They would go through and harvest whatever they could get on the first pass, and they would leave some on the stalks for poor people and slaves to go through and collect. Not only that, they would leave the corners of the field intact so that there would always be a way for people to get enough to eat. And so she goes out there, and imagine showing up as the lowest of the lows in society, being known as a Moabite. She's working to try to just provide enough food for her and her mother-in-law. And this had to have been difficult. But her attitude seemed really good. And as you read through chapter 2, you see that she came upon a particular field, and there's a guy named Boaz who owns that field. And it says that he was really a rich guy. He was also a relative of Naomi's. And so as she is gleaning in the fields, Boaz notices her. And he asks the guys that work with him, who's the good-looking girl? And they said, oh, that's the Moabite. She's the daughter-in-law of Naomi, your relative. And he said, wow, that's nice. And he went and talked to her, and he told her that he was impressed by how kind she was to her mother-in-law. And he said, from now on, just glean my field. You don't need to go anywhere else. We'll take care of you. And I've already told the young men, they don't touch you. And you can hang out with the women, the slaves from my, you know, property, but you can glean. And then he told his guys who were harvesting, when you see this Moabite girl, Ruth, behind you, leave a little extra. So she comes home, and she has this huge basket of grain. And, you know, she's like, you know, Naomi says, whoa, where did you glean today? And she said, oh, I ran into a guy named Boaz. And Naomi goes, he's a relative. She said, from now on, you glean his field all the time. And so, you know, Boaz was nice to her. He shared his lunch with her. She's gleaning in his field. It worked well throughout the harvest, but now it's the end of the harvest at the end of chapter 2. And now Naomi has to figure out, what are we going to do now? And she decided it was time to make their move. Now, in their culture, there was a law called the Kinsman Redeemer Law, the Goel Law. And what it said was, if a family is destitute and you are their relative, that you are able to redeem them, you are able to pay the price to have what is theirs traditionally from their family, and now you're connected to them and everything that they own, you own. And it was really a gracious way of kind of a bankruptcy where someone as a relative could come along and redeem somebody. And so Naomi, you know, thought, man, our only hope is to be redeemed. And so she tells Ruth, when they've finished, at this point, it's the end of the harvest, so they will be thrashing the wheat all day and then winnowing it. Wait until Boaz is tired, and then they had a big party to celebrate the harvest, so he's been drinking, he will fall asleep, and then go in there and slip into the foot of his bed as he's sleeping there on the threshing floor. Now, usually preachers always say that was a tradition that they would always do, but we base the tradition, as near as I can tell, just from this one story, because there's no other example of it I can find. But at any rate, she said, lay down at his feet, snuggle up in his bed at his feet, and then if he wakes up, tell him, you're my relative. I would love to be redeemed by you. I would love for you to take me as a wife. So he's in the middle of the night. He starts, you know, feeling a lump in his bed. And he looks down there, and there's this good-looking Moabite girl that he's been kind of eyeing from afar. And she says, Boaz, I want you to redeem me. I would love to be your wife if you could pull this off. Now, let's talk about Boaz for a bit. Boaz was single, and he was old. He was probably 50, 60, something like that, judging from the genealogies. he hadn't found anyone who really wanted to be married to him, apparently. That's why when he says, I can't believe you would pick me. You could pick some young guy. And you're going for an old dude like me. This is amazing to me. See, here's the deal with Boaz. You talk about environment. Okay, he lives in Bethlehem. But the environment, he was used to it, and he was wealthy. But if you look at his heredity, if you go back to his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, it's a guy named Perez. Perez was the first Mexican in the Bible. And no, not really. But Perez was a son of Judah, Judah of the tribe of Judah fame. But the problem is Perez's mother was Tamar. Tamar was the daughter-in-law of Judah. Because she was afraid she was never going to get married again, she dressed up like a prostitute, had relations with Judah, not letting him know that I'm your daughter-in-law. So she was dressed, I don't know, apparently in those days, prostitutes wore more clothes, not less, but he doesn't recognize her. She's impregnated, and their child, Perez. He carried that with him. They saw that being a descendant, not bragging of Judah, but a descendant of Tamar and Perez. And that would have been a real insult. However, a few generations down, his mother married a Jew named Salmon. Now, that's kind of fishy, but his mother, you might remember her. We call her Rahab the harlot. His mom was known for being a prostitute. Now, she was responsible for helping Israel, you know, make their first move into Jericho. Her life was spared as a result, and then she married Salmon. But whenever Boaz was born, you have to know he probably grew up as like your mother. We know what she did for a living. Perhaps even his parentage was questioned. Like when you're born to a prostitute, how do you know who the father is? So Boaz grows up with this hanging over his head, and we'll see later in the story it comes up again. So here's a guy who's past his prime, who has this cloud genetically over him, his heredity seriously questionable. And here's this girl from a cursed race, a widow, young widow, and they find themselves together. But when Boaz heard the chance, he's like, oh man, this is what I've been waiting for. And he said, you're going to have to wait because you actually have one relative closer than me. And she goes, oh, you have a picture? No, she didn't. She goes, okay, I hope it works. He goes, I'm going to do what I can. So she went home, told Naomi, there's one relative who's closer. I'm not sure he has a field. So she goes, don't worry, this guy, he's been taking care of you. He will not rest until he brings this to a resolution. And so we read where Boaz in chapter 4 goes to the guy who's the closest relative. And he says, hey, got good news for you. You know, you're closely related to Elimelech, to Naomi. And he said, their property is up for auction. And you have the first shot at redeeming it. And the guy goes, awesome, I'll take it. And he goes, well, there's just one thing. There's a young Moabite widow that's a part of the estate. So if you take the property, you're going to have to marry the girl. Just kind of some regular looking Moabite girl. And so the guy goes, oh man, my wife would never put up with that. So he goes, I can't do it. So the way this kinsman redeemer law would work, that guy who couldn't redeem took off his sandal and handed it to Boaz, and that was like a contract. Boaz would slap him in the face with his sandal as kind of an insult, and then there are witnesses there who would say, yep, he got the sandal. Now he has the right. And so Boaz announces to the people there in the gates, which was their court system, that this contract had been made, and they acknowledged, yep, we saw it. You can marry Ruth. There in chapter 4, in verse 11, it said, all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel. And may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem, which isn't saying much. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. This was really a backhanded blessing. It's like, yeah, may you be in the kind of situation like Rachel and Leah. Now let's, you know, just think, you know, your ancestors. I mean, Judah and Tamar, through that gross, deceptive interaction, your ancestor Perez was born. So maybe something good can come from this sleazy union. From you, the loser, and a Moabite woman, maybe something good will come out of this. So he's like, well, gee, thanks, I'm touched. And he goes right away, he can't wait. He married, the rest of the story is he married Ruth. He was so excited. They had a child named Obed, and Naomi gets to help raise her grandson. And that's kind of the rest of the story, except that in the end it gives some genealogical information where it says they named him Obed. Obed's the father of Jesse, the father of David. So the genealogy is this: Perez to Hezron, Hezron to Ram, Ram to Amminadab, Amminadab to Nahshon, Nahshon begot Salmon, Salmon with Rahab, we find out in Matthew chapter 1, begot Boaz, Boaz begot Obed, Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. So out of the ugliness of Judah and Tamar, out of the humiliation of Salmon and Rahab, and out of this unlikely union of a Moabitess and an old guy who nobody thought would ever amount to anything, comes the son of the father of David, the greatest king in Israel. And what a cool way to wrap the story up. It's like, look at what comes out of this. Heredity, problematic. Environment, challenging and difficult. But the fruit of all of it became David, who then Jesus brags about being of the seed of David. And so all of this ultimately is the messianic line. Yeah, it was a big deal for Judah to be in the messianic line. Jesus would be called the Lion of the tribe of Judah, but Judah's kid, Perez, came from his union with his daughter-in-law, and on down, and you get a Canaanite prostitute, you get a Moabite girl, and all of that, and what comes out of it is this beautiful love story in such an unlikely place and an unlikely time.
You're listening to The Balanced Word. In addition to being our teacher on the program, Dave Rolfe is the pastor of Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel in Aliso Viejo. We're going through the Bible right now in a series called Bible Stories. We have these messages archived for you at thebalancedword.com, or call and request today's message on CD at 949-362-7475. And as a special appreciation gift for your donation of $10 or more, The Balanced Word is pleased to send you all of these messages in this Bible Stories series on a USB thumb drive. You'll hear some of the Bible's greatest stories from Genesis through Revelation. To make a secure donation, go to thebalancedword.com or call 949-362-7475. And don't forget to ask for the Bible Story series as you give. Again, we're at thebalancedword.com. And we'd like to take this time to invite you to Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel. Our Sunday morning service times are at 8, 9:45, and 11:30. Again, we're at ccpacifichills.org if you'd like more information. Or if you're outside of the area, you can watch our live stream right there at ccpacifichills.org. Check out Pastor Dave's one-minute messages, a great way to start the day. You can listen to them at thebalancedword.com or watch them on Instagram or Facebook by following CC Pacific Hills. We'll leave you with this encouragement from our pastor and teacher, Dave Rolfe.
Are you crying? There'll come a day when you feel better. Do you feel like your life has gone up in smoke and now it's ashes? Beauty can come forth out of these ashes. It will rise, in fact. And it can, and we get to see that happen in people's lives. Look at your own life and think of where you could be if it was all about just biology and environment. Instead, the truth is, God's working in your life to do something way better than you ever thought he would.
Discovering balanced living through the Word of God, this has been The Balanced Word with Dave Roth. We'll have another great Bible story for you next time. This program is brought to you by Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel in Aliso Viejo. Online at thebalancedword.com.
Wake up, my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up, my hands. And yeah.